The Feather of the Falcon by Herb Childress. Svetlana Yates had come to Granby, Missouri, 23 years before as a mail-order bride. The man who visited her village, a recruiter, had been very polite, surprisingly young, perhaps 30, perhaps younger. He had spoken to her mother and father as well, promising the Trusov family that their daughter would be met with excitement and wealth in a shining city. That, plus the 30,000 rubles offered to her parents, had been enough. The recruiter had brought her, along with three other girls from Yarnamskaya, to Arkhangelsk, where they lived in a dormitory with 20 or so others, were photographed in party dresses and sports clothes. Most departed within a few weeks. She had since found many of the other girls through Facebook, understood that her fate could have been worse. Dickie Yates, always Dickie, never Richard or Rich, owned a garage and a diner, three on-the-way mini-marts, two apartment buildings, always the 12 and the 18, never their addresses, and a coin laundry. Dickie reminded her of the Communist Party officers who owned the good lands and taverns and inns and warehouses of the Plesetsky district. If someone made him laugh, he wasn't averse to it, but would never think to do that kindness on behalf of someone else. He had grown up with cows and corn, understood the conversion of labor to money, thought of himself in only those terms. Lana, always Lana, never Svetlana, ran the Four Corners Laundry, so named for Dickie's management company, itself so named for the region's location within the 30-minute notch of Missouri, Kansas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. She stocked the soda and chip machine, swept and then mopped the weary linoleum aisles before unlocking the shop. During the day, she washed and dried and folded for customers who had more money than time, sold soap, made change, cleared lint traps, cleaned the wheeled baskets and the long counters on which sad women folded blouses and underwear. Dickie had taught her how to replace a drive belt on a dryer, how to change motor assemblies in a washer, how to clear jammed quarters in the coin-op slider while ensuring that the customer had actually put in the right number, not cheated. She was self-sufficient, ran the Four Corners herself 6 days a week from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. She had employed a replacement worker only twice during 21 years of her oversight, for 2 weeks after the birth of Sandy, 2 weeks, 2 years later, for Julie. Always Sandy, always Julie, never Xenia and Yulia for her grandmothers. Sandy and Julie had been raised in the laundry, had worked there themselves at one of the mini-marts from the time they were in grade school. Sandy, the athletic one, was now a cross-country runner at nearby Missouri Southern State. The bookish and unsettled Julie at Reed College in faraway Oregon, as far away as the Onega River of Lana's childhood. Both girls had excelled at things they could do on their own, since they worked at the laundry or another of Dickie's businesses during every non-school moment, had no time for clubs or events that responded to others' schedules. The man who recruited Julie to Reed College reminded her of the man who came to visit her parents 2 decades before, young and respectful, taking a daughter off to some imperceptible, gleaming future. She had taught her girls that they should rely on themselves and themselves alone. Dickie had taught them that if they worked hard, they got paid. She hoped those two lessons would suffice. She knew no others. Lana knew that it happened at mid-morning on a Thursday because Ellen was in with her weekly loads, one washer filled completely by her husband's blue shop shirts from Earl's RV Sales and Service. About half of the machines were occupied, three customers, one with two toddlers squealing in that unnaturally high pitch unique to American children. The sound reminded Lana of hawks hunting over the river's edge. A young man came in alone with no laundry bag or basket. Once he had got past the soda and chip machines, she knew there would only be two possibilities. He would ask for a job, or he would demand money. She considered the aluminum baseball bat under the counter as she scanned past his shoulder. The babies were playing on the floor, the women reading magazines or shoulders deep into a dryer. She would not challenge him with little ones in the shop, would not put them at risk. She would acquiesce. As he neared the counter, she conducted a mental inventory so that she could report back to Dickie and the sheriff's deputy. Middle 20s, certainly not yet 30. Black hair, cut poorly but recently. Equal to her height, eyes level. Dark skin, darkened further by outdoor work. Plain white t-shirt, low-cost jeans but fairly new, scuffed but sturdy work boots. Wiry, hard, no tattoos visible on his forearms or hands, every muscle of his arms visible, no padding under the skin. Strong and hungry both, she thought, though she would not add that to the report. Hello, she said, nothing more, making him declare his intentions. Hello, he said, and she added a Spanish accent to her inventory. I am looking for work. What kind of work? Fix machines, he said. You have many machines here, and carpenter, plumber, anything broken. Her judgment was that this was all true, and she relaxed. Dickie was not averse to hiring an undocumented worker, and always had repair projects at two or three properties at once. He might need another man, strong and hungry. Can you repair coolers? Yes, and ACs. What is your name? Ramiel. Ray. She could not bear another lost name. Ramiel, I am Svetlana. Where are you from?
I live here in Granby by the market.
But where are you from before? He looked at her closely, clearly making the same sort of assessment that she had. Was she safe, or would she harm him? Long seconds passed, and finally, without breaking eye contact, he said, Belize. She nodded. I am from Russia, more than 20 years ago. How long have you been here?
A year, some more.
You have family in Belize?
Yes.
Wife, 2 babies, 4 and 3 years, girls. I send money when I have. She took a small square of cardboard from the pile she kept to level washing machines, said, write your name and phone and I'll ask if we need a worker. She slid the cardboard to him. He glanced at the plastic cup of pens next to the register and said, may I? A man came in today looking for work. He says he can fix most machines, do building repairs, refrigeration. Dickie mopped a last ragged square of bread through the remaining traces of mashed potato and butter on his plate. There was never a streak or a scrap left after Dickie's dinner. He hated waste more than he hated any other thing. The only arguments he had ever had with his daughters weren't over cars or boys or grades, but over not finishing dinner, leaving good food behind. Joey's swamped right now, he said. Got a big leak on the roof of the 18. Gonna need to fix the drywall and the units all the way down that side. Be good to have help. Joey, always Joey, never Jose, was from southern Mexico, had come to the U.S. not long after Lana herself, after his wife had been killed. They had had no children, so he saw no need to stay in his town or his nation, came to the U.S. Dickie had picked him up in a day labor line at the Lowe's and kept him on all these years. Now, nearing 50, Joey was Dickie's primary repairman on every building he owned, and the Immigration Service had clamped down on day labor pools. Dickie understood markup, understood that it was cheaper to pay wages to his own man than to pay the wages of someone else's man, avoided contractors whenever he could. Joey can call him tomorrow, he said. She gave him the paper on which she had written Ray's name and number. She had kept the original cardboard square in her purse, the square for which Ramiel had asked her permission before using her pen. After dinner, she cleaned the kitchen while Dickie went through the day's mail, paid household bills. She thought about an almost unimaginable state, a life in which others asked her permission, sought her advice. She had not thought of this for many years, but she remembered as a child when her mother would read her stories. She had been captivated by The Feather of the Falcon, not for the larger story of the falcon prince who married the girl, but rather for the very beginning of the story, in which the merchant asked his 3 daughters what they wanted him to bring them from the fair. A father who asked his daughters what they wanted. More magical than any falcon prince. Dickie had provided for her well, had built a comfortable home with modern features, paid Lana and their daughters a fair wage for their work, as well as sustaining the costs of the household himself. but he could only see one way of thinking, one body of motives, and called them human nature or common sense, as though they were uniform, as though it was impossible for any other person to hold a desire unlike his own. He chose the car she drove, a Corolla, for its reliability, 3 years used to avoid the greatest depreciation, white, to stay cooler in summer. He told her to buy house brands at the grocery, lesser cuts of meat, not because they couldn't afford more, but because it made no sense to spend money that wasn't warranted. He held his meetings with bankers and his managers over breakfast in his own diner, eating 2 scrambled eggs with cheese and hash browns every morning for 20 years. He had never wanted to be a farmer after having grown up with that endless, brutal labor, but he had never left that way of life behind. He bought not possessions, but equipment, functional and rational. He bought not food, but feed, sufficient in quantity and quality. Nothing was better nor worse than was necessary. He never traveled, never questioned, never read. She had told herself it was enough. She had asked him once, only once, early on, why he had brought her from Russia for marriage rather than take one of the countless local women who would have wanted a comfortable, stable life. He had told her that no young American girl wanted a farmer. When he left farming in his late 20s, most of the women were already married, and those that weren't were deep into various troubles, drugs, small crime, random children. He would never accept a child that was not of his seed stock, not for moral reasons, but because it just wouldn't be his. It would be a weed, not a crop. He had told her that he had kept busy as a young man, that he was never lonely, but on his 40th birthday, he decided that he still wanted a child, and that it would not be right to be 60 years old when his son or daughter graduated from high school. So he examined his possibilities. Lana, then 19, had been one of them. He had named his list of criteria as though she had once been the Corolla under consideration. She was white. She was young enough to have heavy, healthy children, and pretty enough that they wouldn't be hindered by unattractiveness. She spoke some limited English. She, like he, had grown up on a farm, would not be afraid of work. She had been equipped with the correct options for his requirements. He had been clumsy about sex, but not shy, nor abusive. He had grown up around cattle, understood the biology. He wanted her to be comfortable, to not experience distress, and so he was gentle, but understood nothing of women's deeper needs. After Sandy and Julie arrived, they had had sex perhaps 4 more times, not more than 6. He was a man for whom pleasure was not a meaningful concept. Comfort, yes. He often slept nestled up against her, an arm across her shoulders. She told herself that that was enough, too. Raimiel had quickly become indispensable, able to anticipate Joey's thoughts and to have materials or solutions at hand. He was indeed adept at rapidly diagnosing and repairing mechanical and construction problems, had gotten the beer cooler at Minimart 3 to run reliably for the first time since it was installed. Dickie had commented over dinner that the two men were able to keep pace during summer for the first time in 3 years. He said that without gratitude, no more than one might be grateful to the cooler itself. The situation was working well. That success was commented on and then left aside in the face of new challenges and opportunities. Dickie was planning to build a strip mall out on Route 44A, and the combination of finances and structural design and permits had kept him fully occupied. One rainy, dark morning at the laundry, an old, brittle hose tore along its length, the water line for washer 17. She quickly shut the valve to that washer, moved her one customer to machines away from the problem, set up a wet floor sign on both sides, returned with the mop bucket. There had been no replacement hose on the wall pegs, so she called Joey's number and asked him to bring 5 feet of flexible rubber hose, a male and female coupling on the ends. After the cleanup, the shop was empty. Rainy days always meant slow. Nobody wanted to get their fresh laundry wet on the trips out to the car. She took the luxury of a cigarette, one of 3 that she allowed herself each day, standing outside the shop under the awning. American Spirits. She bought them herself from the gas station next door. Dickie would have gotten her Mavericks, her Checkers. She looked out at the puddles in the parking lot, the sheets of water rolling down the curb cut. That was life. Rain, and then dry. Hot, and then cold. Flooded, and then mopped. Dirty, and then clean. Young, and then not. She finished her cigarette, stubbed it, and dropped it into the plastic smoker's pole next to the bench, took a mint from the tin in her apron, went back inside. Her own dryer had stopped. She unloaded Becky's wash into a basket, hung shirts and pants, folded socks and underwear and dish towels. She heard Joey's voice from behind the door. "Good morning, Miss Lana." She turned, saw Joey and Ramiel. Joey carried his perpetual toolbox. She had scarcely ever seen him without it. Ramiel had a heavy coil of hose over one arm, resting on his shoulder. "We were supposed to do foundation work over at the garage, but the weather... So we decided to check all the hoses, keep you from having a problem again." "Thank you," she said. "That will be good." But her eyes were fully on Ramiel as he bent to set down the hose. His baggy workman's jeans shifted and tightened as he moved in ways that caught her attention. She felt, perhaps, admiration that something so right could exist here, that this weary laundry was purified by his presence. Joey went to the storeroom and returned with the pallet jack. "Good to have an empty room," he said. "Ray is turning off the water supply to the whole line. We can do all of them together." He slid the jack under one washer after another, pulling them 2 feet out into the aisle. She went to the end of the row, looked down the newly revealed space behind the washers, a wilderness of socks and soap boxes, lint and mud, the usually limp hoses now suspended taut across the gap. When Joey had pulled about half of the washers forward, Ramiel began to pick his way along behind them, running his hands along each hose in turn, evaluating whether it was supple and could be saved, or hard and brittle and in need of replacement. For each one he deemed beyond safe use, he reached over and lifted the washer's lid as a marker. She watched his hands, dark and nimble, found herself wondering what it would be like to thread her fingers between his. She felt herself growing less brittle, more supple. After reviewing each hose, Ramiel put his right hand on top of the washer, his left on top of the divider wall that held the plumbing lines, and pressed himself up, pulling his knees up to his chest, his feet above the hose, and then down into the next space. The muscles of his back and shoulders shifted as he moved. His plain gray t-shirt was a revelation. Once he had reached the end of his inspection, he hoisted himself over the top of a washer and down into the linoleum aisle. The two men went back to the storeroom to cut lengths of hose, attach fittings. She went with them to retrieve a broom, and then back to the washers. She put the broom behind the last washer, then walked to the first, looking down the sequential bridges of hose behind the machines. She did what she had seen Ramiel do, pressing herself up and over the lines, one square at a time like a board game. She had remained slim, found that she could easily navigate the obstacles, felt proud and strong. She reached the end and began sweeping away the debris of years. She was nearing the start of the row when Ramiel returned. They were four washers apart, separated by four stretched lengths of line, regarding one another. After a few moments, he said, "I start replacing. Joey, make more hoses." She nodded, pushed the growing pile of debris forward, lifted herself into the next bay. Ramiel smiled at her. Then he gestured, as though sweeping, held his hand toward the broom, and said, "May I?" She passed him the broom, and he reached way in and dragged the mess out into the aisle through the gap. He passed the broom back in, said, "More easy now for you." "Thank you." She finished sweeping behind the last machines. As she was about to lift herself one last time, he looked directly at her and said quietly, "You work so hard. May I?" "Yes," she said. She felt his hands at her waist, lifting her over the last hose, carrying her down and setting her gently in front of him. She wanted those hands on her waist. She wanted those hands everywhere. She wanted him to ask her for permission, and she wanted to give him permission for every request. That night, at about 9:30, Lana's phone rang. She knew immediately that it would be Yulia. The only other people who ever called her were Dickie, Joey, and the girls, and Sandy was independent while Yulia needed regular conversations. Yulia had decided after a few weeks of college to go by her birth name, and Lana was secretly proud. She dried her hands and picked up. Hi, Mom.
Hello, Yulia. How are you?
I'm good, but I'm stressing about finals.
You have never once had a school test that you had a hard time with. You will be fine.
I know, but this is college. It's a little harder.
She heard the smile in her daughter's voice.
Dickie looked up at her from the couch. She put her hand over the phone and said, Julie.
He nodded, pantomimed a wave to her, but didn't move to be part of the call.
Daddy says hello.
Can you go somewhere where you can talk without him around?
Pregnant. She immediately ran through ideas on how to tell Dickie, none of which would go well. Yes, let me go off to the bedroom so that we don't disturb Daddy, she said a little louder than necessary as she walked away. What tests are you most worried about?
Yulia talked about her Russian language course, about the story she was writing for her fiction course, as Lana walked down the hall, closing the bedroom door behind her.
Okay, she said, walking into the master bath. I am alone.
What do you want to tell me?
Oh my God, Mom, I'm in love.
This is good. Tell me all about him.
She hoped it was a him. The alternative would be another tense conversation.
His name is Philip. He's from Minneapolis. He's in my physics study group. He's super smart and he's really nice.
And what does his family do?
His father's a lawyer. He works on civil rights cases for the state's Justice Department. His mother's a high school principal.
She thought briefly about how Yulia would have described her and Dickie, would have described Granby. This would seal her departure from them forever. She would not come home to a world of mini-marts and laundromats.
This is all very nice. Why are you telling me this so Daddy won't hear, though?
You will not be his baby girl forever. He knows there will be a boy someday.
A long pause.
Philip is black. He's not really African-American. His family's all from the Caribbean, so he's more Afro-Dominican, but his parents grew up in the U.S.
Yulia was filling in the space with facts, sealing with words against the air that could cause ignition.
Lana waited until Yulia had run herself out and then said,
Well, you are right. Your father will have a hard time with this.
How about you, Mom? Are you okay?
Her two daughters, so different.
Sandy, never a moment of doubt, all of her father's logical American certainty that doors would open and effort would be repaid.
Yulia, reclaiming her historic name, filled with Russian pensiveness, a million questions and confidences with her mother over the years.
You have entrusted me with a secret, she said, and I am happy for you.
So I will tell you something as well.
She opened the bathroom door to ensure that Dickie wasn't in the bedroom, closed it again, took a steadying breath.
I have also found a boy.
Mom! Oh my God, are you and Daddy getting divorced? Where are you going to go? How are you going to make a living?
Lana smiled at the questions. Yulia had little affection for her father. She knew the difference between love and obligation, had inherited some of her mother's loneliness that she sought to dispel through telling stories.
You hoped that I would be calm with your news. You can be calm with mine.
No, we are not getting divorced. I have not had sex with this man.
But he sees me in a way that your father never has, and he makes me feel like I am a person, and not merely an employee.
Who is he? Where'd you meet him? What's he like?
And the two of them shared their stories, expats connecting in a distant land. Svetlana listened to Ramiel breathing softly as he slept next to her in the dark, a snowstorm raging outside their motel room in Kansas City. She had gone to Portland to visit Yulia over the winter break, had met Philip and approved greatly, had returned 3 days early, and called the number that had lived on that cardboard square in her purse for 2 months. She knew that fairy tales weren't real, that falcons didn't turn into princes. that this was only a vacation and not a life. But to find a man who asked permission, who asked what she wanted, a man who was strong and hungry, that would live with her. That would give her courage, as fairy tales should do.